Swans fans, it's been a long 6 months of licking our wounds, enduring Collingwood fans and trying to work out what to make of pre-season training form and practice match results. But finally, round one is upon us and we get to start our pilgrimage to the MCG to kick off season 2024. I'm Jonathan Walsh and joining me in Don the Stats studio to preview our round one clash against the Hawks is Ian Hume. Humey, how's things, mate?
Yeah, I'm doing good. I'm just super excited for round one footy. I can't wait to get down there on Saturday and see the boys run out. And look, as Kevin Garnett once said, anything is possible, especially at the beginning of the year. So I really can't wait to see how things pan out. How about yourself?
Yeah, I'm good, mate. I'm trying to work out who Kevin Garnett is. But yeah, other than that, I'm good, mate. Work's busy. Lots of good stuff going on there. And yeah, footy's back. So I'm, couldn't be happier, mate.
That's all right. I'm sure there'll be a fair few people on Twitter who'll be able to inform you as to who KG was. Look, before we get stuck in tonight, a couple of notes. Firstly, SM Pete on Twitter has kindly offered to run a Don the Stats Supercoach League for season 2024. The code to join that will be in the description of this episode, and whoever wins the league will receive a Don the Stat t-shirt of their choice. So a big thanks to Pete for getting that up and running. And again, big thanks to everyone who signed up to the Patreon this week. Shout out to Joe, Chris Sheehan, Diane Trask, Cam Grinham, and Mitchell Nash. Thanks for joining our burgeoning community.
Yeah, thanks to Pete for doing that. And yeah, thanks to everyone who's jumped on board the Patreon. We don't take it for granted that people are prepared to spend a little bit of their hard-earned to help support us. We're really, really grateful. And you shared another great video this week, mate, on centre bounce attendances, which got a lot of great discussion happening. So yeah, really excited by what we've been doing there and the discussion that's happening. And I'm sure there's going to be lots of good stuff coming throughout the year.
That's right. And looking forward to tracking that centre bounce attendance data in detail and trying to dig deeper than what we can see on the surface. Look, let's start by having a quick look at what happened in opening round. And I guess it was really weird seeing the AFL season commence without the Bombers playing that weekend with the new opening round concept. What we did get to see, though, was an early look at a few teams who would be hoping to push for premiership contention. There's probably five or six of the main premiership contenders played in that week. Any takeaways from how those teams are looking and if there's any early signs of differences in how teams are playing this year compared to last?
Yeah, I think there's lots of noise and people jumping to conclusions or media analysts jumping to conclusions on if you won, you're a premiership fancy, and if you lost, it's doom and gloom already. But yeah, it's a long season, isn't it? And there's going to be peaks and troughs for all teams. I did mention when I was on with Craig on a Yank on the Footy podcast a couple of weeks ago that I think the game will start to open up a little more and that faster ball movement will come back into vogue and that scoring could increase. And I think we saw some signs of that in the first four games across opening round or round zero. I think we're starting to see a bit more dare and drive from half back. I think there were almost times in the past where we were criticised for that being our one wood and now we're seeing some teams really favour that. Four of the eight teams had 60 or more inside 50s, albeit two of them actually lost the game. So, yeah, I think we're definitely seeing some faster ball movement and more emphasis put on offence rather than just, you know, defensive mechanisms. I do have one little random stat for you, mate, that came out of the first four games. Of the eight teams who played in opening round, one of them only had one inside 50 tackle for the game. Do you want to guess who it was?
Well, that's a tough one. I didn't quite look at the stats as closely as you have for those games, considering we weren't playing either of any of those teams this week. But I guess based on the results, I'm going to have to go with Richmond, who are probably the poorest looking side of the eight that played that week. And
yeah, it wasn't. It was actually the team who was probably the most impressive of the weekend in GWS. I don't think that's necessarily, a sign into how they want to play. I think it was just a little bit more situational and they were pretty effective at scoring when they did go forward. So a little bit of a weird one out of the first week of matches.
Yeah, I guess sometimes with the inside 50 tackle count, if you're marking everything that goes inside 50, you're not going to be having many tackles inside 50. So, you know, if you're effective at getting the ball to your forwards on the full without having to go through that contested stage, you're not going to end up with a lot of inside 50 tackles there. I guess just in general, what did you think about the idea of opening round?
Yeah, I like it. I'm a a footy fan at heart. Essendon's obviously my passion, but I am a fan of the game, and I like the idea of growing the game up north. I think for the league to expand and to have 18 and soon 19 and probably at some stage 20 teams, we do need to attract more kids playing footy and building the development pathways up north in particular. Now, particularly now that we've got the four teams. So yeah, I think giving those states the opportunity to really showcase the game without the distraction of games in other cities, I think is a really good idea. Whether that needs to be round zero or another part of the season, I'm not too sure. But yeah, I liked it. I just would have split it with this week and had five games this week so that everyone can get on an even standing, an even playing card sooner, rather than having the buys sort of spread out over 4 or 5 weeks.
Yeah, it's going to cause a bit of confusion and interruption for certain teams. We've seen generally with the buys mid-season how teams can come off slowly after that. And, teams are going to play three or four games and then have a buy, and that could affect their momentum. But look, I think my favorite comment about opening round, and I can't remember where I saw this, so I really do apologize to the person who came up with it. But the ideas for opening, best thing about opening round was it was great, but next year they should play games on Sunday, involve the 10 other teams, play games across the country, and just call it round one. That was the favorite comment I saw about opening round there.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other option, isn't it, mate? I'm not sure how happy I would have been sitting at the G last week, though, in 39 degrees. That would have been a little bit of a test. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that evolves next year. But of course, mate, we've got more important matters. So let's move on with looking forward to round one.
Yeah, and I guess we've been looking forward to round one for over 100 days now with the Domstat countdown to Essendon's first game. And we're finally reaching the end of that countdown. We posted number two today and then number one tomorrow, and then it'll be game day. It's been so positively received by everyone. So thanks to everyone who's engaged with that across the variety of platforms that we've posted it. And look, Jono, this is your baby. You came up with the idea and you've done the bulk work of designing all the images that go out with it and originally posting it there across a variety of platforms. Do you have any standout moments from the countdown?
Yeah, it was day 111 that we started, so it has been a bit of a marathon. Look at the, lots of them. It was just nice to spend some time researching some of the players that I'd heard about from, my dad or my grandfather, but didn't necessarily know all that much about. Harold Lambert was day 99. He played 99 games. He was a member of our 1946, 49, and 50 premierships. And missed 4 years due to World War II and ended up being ranked number 25 in the Champions of Essendon. So he was someone that, I sort of knew and heard his name and knew a little bit about, but in the process of putting together some of this research, I read a bit more about him and really enjoyed that. And another one was Greg Stockdale, who he kicked 68 goals in our 1923 Premiership season, which at the time was the VFL and Essendon record for the most goals kicked in a season, and remained Essendon's record until Tom Reynolds passed it. He kicked 71 in 1939. So yeah, just some of those players whose names I'd sort of heard and it had floated up, but I didn't necessarily know a lot about. It was good to read a little bit more about them. What about you, mate?
Yeah, and just on Tom Reynolds, I admit I didn't realise Dick had a brother until doing the research for this. And having seen that we've got a Tom and a Dick, it was a shame that the Reynolds patriarch and matriarch didn't have a third. When they'd had their third son, they didn't call him Harry. I think they've missed a trick there. But anyway, and I really got into researching these once you let me come on board and help you out there. And I spent far too much time on AFL tables trying to pick out the best stats. And there's plenty that stick out. I think one of them I actually counted manually was the amount of games not featuring a Danaher from the start of Terry's time at Essendon until Chris's end. That really stood out. It ended up being 43, and I had to count out and cross-reference each of their playing careers and work out when there wasn't one in the team. So, one in 10 games across that period, there wasn't a Danaher. Another favorite one is the Mark Bolton effect on Adam Goods. Was a fun one to what eventually confirmed a long-held fan theory about Bolton's effect on Goods, which came out at number 13. And then recently, number three being the week's Chris Tarrant thought he had Mark of the Year sewn up before Moorcroft took his grab in 2001. That was a great one to write. And just having the opportunity to take numerous pot shots at clubs like North Melbourne and Carlton along the way was an added bonus.
Yeah, having a crack at North is always a little bit of fun, and the Blues for that matter. So yeah, you certainly did the heavy lifting on a lot of those more obscure ones, mate. So thank you for your work that you did there. It was it was fascinating and a job well done.
Yeah. All right. Well, look, let's move to what was in the news this week. And probably the big non-on-the-field news from Essendon this week came about, once again, due to some pretty average reporting by some of the football pundits. And I think most people have probably heard the Brad Scott 8 years comments or heard it through different sources other than Brad himself. And there does seem to be a bit of confusion or willful misinterpretation, depending on how you feel about the media, about some of his comments in an interview he did with the Herald Sun. And he spoke about the players being on an 8-year journey, which some of the pundits have taken to mean Essendon won't see success for 8 years. And we saw pundits like John Ralph and David King and Matthew Lloyd up in arms saying it was all about setting up an excuse for poor performance. And I think it's just a gross misrepresentation of what Brad said. And I think it's important that we look at his actual words and get a sense of what he actually meant from that. So I'm just going to read a couple of extracts here from the interview. But when you think about Reed, Cox, Jones, Perkins, Hobbs, and Caldwell, you put them all together and there's a profile that doesn't look that dissimilar to the players at clubs who are rebuilding. So what's the difference? We tend to fall into this thing of we haven't won a final in 20 years, so we just have to do it. But that shortcut gets you nowhere. Marry up the facts with the reality. Essendon fans should be really excited that outside of a few veterans, this group has the potential to play together for the next 8 years, and I include Gresham, Dersma, and Mackay in that. The nucleus of what we got is here. That is where the bulk of the improvement is going to come from. So he's not saying it's going to take 8 years to be successful. What he's saying is that the group of players that is currently together with their age profile and the quality or the talent that's on the list, they have an 8-year period where they can play together and build cohesion to try to build towards success. It's just, he sees that this side, this group has an 8-year window where to compete for flags, not that it's going to take 8 years to compete for a flag.
Yeah, it's ridiculous, isn't it? I honestly feel worn out by footy media already. We haven't even got to round one. I guess we shouldn't be surprised at the way that they go about things, but yeah, it still manages to catch a lot of people off guard and they buy into it, and it ultimately just spreads the wrong message about the club, which, or in this case, Brad Scott, which I think is really, really unfair.
Yeah, and I think to further demonstrate that what he was saying wasn't about accepting poor performance or accepting mediocrity, he goes on to say, and again, this is a direct quote from the article, "Don't think we are just cruising and we are accepting mediocrity, because we are absolutely not," he said. "But if you can't maintain some stability and keep a laser-like focus through the ups and downs, you aren't going to be able to work through it. Our recent history, and by that I mean 2 decades, shows that." So at least based on his words, there's no acceptance of mediocrity for the playing list. That's the words of a man who is focused on not only getting a side to achieve their best, but to make sure that whatever is created is both repeatable and sustainable across that window of time he's talking about, where these players can build and work together to create something special, hopefully. And we've seen that having a stable and well-run club with excellent culture and expectations can do with teams. So we've seen, you know, teams like Geelong and Sydney who have continually competed for flags for the last 20 years. And that doesn't come from nothing. A lot of work went into those clubs to make sure that they developed those cultures and stayed at the top. And to me, that sounds like what Brad Scott wants to build, and not just to be a flash in the pan like we have in the past. And look, even then, you know, an eight-year period, even that is sometimes what it takes for a team's plan to come together. You look at Richmond with Hardwick joining in 2010, they don't win the premiership until 2017. Bomber Thompson joins Geelong for the 2000 season, they win their first flag in 2007. And then the Ruse Goodwin team at Melbourne come together in 2014, and they don't see premiership success until 2021. It's not an unrealistic time frame to build a winning culture or a culture that can get a team to be a premiership success, although you do need to be showing signs of building up to that level of performance along the way. And again, it's going to be 8 years before this team is competitive. They have an 8-year window where they can push for a premiership. It might come earlier, it might come later.
Yeah, and look, there have been examples, haven't there, where Clarkson sort of turned Hawthorn around in 4 years and got them to the promised land. Beveridge was there only a couple, although that really started under McCartney a bit before that, and Beveridge probably got there at a good time to sort of put the cherry on top of his work. But I absolutely do not for a second think that Brad Scott is saying it's going to take 8 years to turn this club and deliver a premiership. I think what he's saying is that we have a core that is now going to allow us, should they improve and uphold the standards that are now expected of an Essendon footballer, that they can be together for 8 years and have a successful period over that 8 year journey, not a flash in the pan with the words he used, weren't they? Not this situation that we've seen in the past where we go up 1 year, get bundled out of the finals, think that's okay, and that it's just going to happen again the next year, and we're back at ground zero again. The other thing that he has done is been absolutely brutally honest at how bad we were and the situation that he found us in, and he hasn't held any punches in what's expected and what's needed to improve. So whilst it's hard not to attach those kind of statements to what's happened in the previous 20 years, Brad Scott's not responsible for that, and he can't undo it. And I know we're all impatient. We want success as quickly as it can possibly come. But I would much rather have a coach come out and tell us the reality of how bad things had been and the things that need to improve than, give us lip service and tell us everything's going to be all right when there's so much work to do. So, I think this has all just been spun out of control. And hopefully, now that we've got nine games of footy being played on a weekend, this sort of stuff can be put to bed and we can just talk about the footy.
Yeah. I guess the other thing that came out of that, and particularly from the midweek tackle, which is where I first saw these sort of ideas raised, was, why did Essendon go out and get these all the spend all the money on the free agents and get Todd Goldstein in if they weren't trying to compete immediately? But I think the facts are we had heaps of cap space that you have to spend anyway. You have to find ways to spend it, and you can either pay players more than they deserve, and that causes problems down the road, or you can use that space to get players in. But again, part of the reason for our poor performance over previous years is that we just haven't had list depth where there's pressure for spots. Players have been able to coast by a bit on lesser efforts, knowing that there was no one who realistically could take their spot in the senior side. And that's the sort of thing that breeds mediocrity. Bringing in these players creates competition for spots. Competition for spots keeps players on their toes and making sure that they're maintaining the standards that are required for a team to be successful.
Yeah, that's right. We've said it before, haven't we, mate? And at the risk of repeating ourselves, we simply just used the resources which we had, which is salary cap space, which we have to use. The AFL says that you have to spend at least 95% of your cap in any given year, and I think you have to spend 100% over any 2 year cycle. So we've used the resource that we've got. The alternative, as you just pointed out, was that we pay that money to the guys that we already had who had proven that they weren't good enough to get us to where we need to be. So we've improved the depth or the floor of our list without having to sell the farm to do it. We've kept our early draft picks. We'll have access to the first round of the draft again next year. And we've still got a lot of cap space to go to free agency and trade market with. So it's not a rise up the ladder with a bullet, but it is a platform that should mean that Essendon fans expect improvement in 2024.
Yeah. Well, look, at the end of the day, if you're an Essendon fan and you're sick of having to see all this media clickbait,
then take a tip from Mr. Paul Anka.
To stop those monsters, 1, 2, 3. Here's a fresh new way that's trouble-free. It's got Paul Anka's guarantee.
Guarantee void in Tennessee. Just don't look. Just don't look. Just don't look.
Wise words to live by.
Yeah, indeed, mate. I like it. Let's get stuck into the Hawks, shall we?
Yep, let's do it. And let's start by looking at the last time we faced the Hawks, which was the same time last year, round one, 2023, where we faced the Hawks having their 40th year premiership celebrations for the 83 grand final. And we managed to rain on their parade, even though it was a bright sunny day, by defeating Hawthorn 9-11-65, with Essendon scoring 19-10-124. It was a fairly tight game for the first half. Both sides took the lead before the Essendon Bombers kicked 11 goals to 4 in the second to run out 59 point winners. So across the game, whilst the battle in the middle of the ground was even, Essendon was able to win the ball six more times at stoppages, and that dominance around the ground allowed them to enter their forward 50 17 more times than the Hawks, and that's what allowed them to kick that winning score. In terms of individual players, Darcy Parrish, who will be absent this week, unfortunately, was the standout player with 37 disposals, 13 clearances, and 9 score involvements, while Zach Merritt had 29, and Will Setterfield playing his first game for the club, having 25. Setterfield was also one of four Essendon players to kick their first goals for Essendon in the game, joining Wiedemann, Alwyn Davey Jr., and Jordan Ridley doing the same. But Archie Perkins led the way with three goals, whilst Anthony McDonald, Tip and Woody gave the fans one last great moment with his goal after coming on as the sub. Looking at the Hawks players, James Sicily led the way with 30 disposals for them, understandable given the ball was in their back line a fair bit, whilst James Warple had 29. Their goal kickers, Luke Bruce, had three, and Blake Hardwick with two were the multiple goal kickers for the Hawks. And unfortunately, it sort of ended up being our highest score and our biggest winning margin for the year. We couldn't improve on either of those marks across the rest of the year.
Yeah, the Hawks do get to celebrate the 40 years of their 83 flag. Of course, we get to celebrate the 40th year of our 84 premiership, and obviously celebrating the back-to-back. Got off to a really promising start, didn't it? There was some, really electric and exciting footy play, particularly in the second half of that game. It was a bit of an arm wrestle for a half, and then we were able to really get on top. Of course, we lost Peter Wright on the eve of the season. Jake Stringer was already out. But we were able to, well, actually, and even before that, Kyle Langford was a defender at that stage as well. And so, yeah, the two guys who were our leading goal kickers the season before, and then Langford, who, we weren't to know at that stage, became our leading goal kicker in 2024, didn't play in our forward line, and we still ended up putting our highest score of the year on the board. So, yeah, we were able to share the load. We kicked four or scored four goals from forward 50 turnovers for the game, along with two more from forward 50 stoppages. So we did a really good job of getting territory, locking the ball in, and using that as a platform to score. And then we also transitioned really well. We kicked two goals from kick-ins, three goals from intercepts in our defensive 50, where we were then able to go to the length of ground and score goals. So yeah, it was a good forward half game as well as a defensive half game, and we were able to get our season off to a bit of a flyer.
Yeah. Well, I guess looking at how Hawthorn went following that game, they only won one of their following eight games, and that was against North Melbourne. So at round nine, they sat at 1-8 and they were last on the ladder with a percentage of 60. Now, they did recover somewhat after that. They won six of their last 14 games, and impressively, they had wins over both grand finalists in Brisbane and Collingwood. So that got them up to 16th on the ladder, so with seven wins and a percentage of 80. If you go into the Hawks stats from last year, one of their big areas of strength was their centre clearance work. They had the second best centre clearance differential behind the Lions, although it was basically line ball. They're basically even on that, just a couple of decimal points. James Warple, Jai Newcombe, and Connor Nash all finished in top 30 for average centre clearances in 2023. No other side had three players in the top 30 for centre clearances. And even in losses, they would still come out ahead in centre clearance. So it was a big strength for them, regardless of whether they were winning or losing. However, they did struggle to win the ball around the ground through stoppage, and they ranked 13th in that. What really defined their game style was their uncontested possessions, though. They were the number one ranked side for uncontested possessions, both in average and in differential to their opponents. However, they weren't doing much with that uncontested possession. They ranked 14th for going inside 50 and 15th for marks inside 50, demonstrating how difficult they found it to find an effective way to goal last year.
Yeah, they're a team that really likes to move the ball by hand, or at least they were in 2023. Their kick-to-handball ratio was 1.22 last season. So, they almost handballed as frequently as they kicked, and that had them ranked 18th in the AFL. They went at 1.47 in their practice match against the Western Bulldogs. So perhaps there were some signs there that they're looking to move the ball a little bit more by foot. And of course, they've recruited Massimo D'Ambrosio, who we all know is a really good kick of the footy. But that still would have had them ranked 8th in the AFL based on last year's numbers. So even with that improvement, it's certainly not up at the levels that some of the better teams are running at. So I think that feeds into that uncontested possession, because more often than not, a handball receive is an uncontested possession.
Yeah. I guess turning around and moving away from uncontested possession and looking at contested aspects of the game, they ranked 15th for contested possession, and they gave away the most contested possessions in the league. So when the ball was in tight in contest, they were more often than not losing control of the ball in those situations.
Yeah, that's right. And look, they do have a young midfield, and they do ask a lot of a few. And it's an area, even in the absence of Darcy Parrish on Saturday, that we'd be hoping we can get some real ascendancy. They'll be expecting improvement from some of their ball winners. You know, Warple and Newcombe were the two that I was really talking about that did most of the heavy lifting last year. They averaged 12 and 11 respectively. Will Day was third. He averaged 9 a game, but he won't be there on Saturday. And then Connor Nash is a player who I think is a little bit underrated in AFL circles. He'll rotate through the midfield and onto the wing. He's a, you know, a really tall, big midfielder, similar sort of body dimensions to Will Setterfield. So he was at 9, and then it dropped down to Sicily as who plays as a key defender or third tall on 8 contested possessions per game. You know, they'll throw McKenzie into the midfield, so they've got some other young midfielders who they'll get through there, who they'll look to see some improvement from. But really, for us, it's an area that even without Parrish, as I mentioned, we should expect to come out on top. But we'll touch a little bit more on that later. Let's have a look, mate, at what the Hawks have done in the offseason.
Yeah, so they had 10 players leave after the 2023 season. So Tyler Brockman, who played 15 games, and Jacob Kaczynski, who played 12, were traded to West Coast and Richmond, respectively, whilst Brandon Ryan, who played 3, was traded to Brisbane. Ruckman Max Lynch retired after playing only one game in 2023, whilst they had 6 listings with Fergus Green, Lockie Bramble, Ned Long, Emerson Jecker, Fiona Hara, and Josh Morris. Of those, Green and Bramble played 11 games and Long 4. So just looking at that, they didn't lose a whole heap of talent there, or a whole heap of talent that they're too worried about losing. I guess they brought 4 players in via trade over the offseason. They sort of did a similar thing to what we did, although they've gone both younger and older than what we were focused on. So they brought in Massimo, obviously, from Essendon, and Premiership Collingwood player Jack Ginnivan. Mabbie Ochoa has come across from Gold Coast, and then they have the favourite son, Jack Gunston, returning from Brisbane. The star of their draft night was live-wire small forward Nick Watson with pick 5. They also picked up medium defender Bodie Ryan at 46. And then they also had 2 father-sons on the evening with Will McCabe and key forward Kelsey Adair, but McCabe is a key defender. So with their open space on their list, they also topped up with defender Ethan Phillips from Box Hill as an SSP selection. So I guess, yeah, as I said, I don't think they've lost a whole lot from last year. I think they've probably improved their list from last year. Chole is a bit of a like-for-like with Kaczynski. Chole has the bonus of being able to relief ruck, so I think that frees them up a little bit more in terms of their lineup. Brockman certainly has some upside, but they've replaced that with 2 good talents in D'Ambrosio and Ginnivan, and then obviously Gunston adds some experience to what is a very young side.
Yeah, I think they've recruited well, mate. I think D'Ambrosio really suits their sort of run and gun and open flow play style, and he'll fit in really well there. I think he'll continue to be exposed defensively. And look, that's something that we might be able to exploit come Saturday. I know Ginnivan has his knockers. He kicked 40 goals 2 seasons ago as a 19-year-old. He's a huge talent. He was really dynamic and played really well. Coming higher up the ground, a bit more as a high half forward, but then running back towards goal in their 2 practice games. And I think Chole is a big upgrade on Kaczynski. I know people might doubt him because he's now at his 3rd club, but I think that's probably a little bit more to do with the connection to Dimmer and perhaps the relationship there. But yeah, he kicked 44 goals 2 years ago at the Suns. And yeah, I think he's going to really slot in well. Jack Gunston's past his best. I might be tempting fate in saying that, but he's still a class act and has had a great career. So I'm sure he'll add plenty of value to there. Mate, it's always the most contentious part of any week of the season, and that's selection night. Given that it's round 1, there's no ins or outs. It's just a team, but that certainly hasn't stopped the Bombers grapevine going into overdrive about it. Let's talk through the teams as they've been selected.
Yeah, and since it's round 1 and we're not got previous teams to look at, we'll name the full teams this week, and then next week we can just start by going through the changes. So Essendon picked from the back line McGrath, Mackay and Heppel. then Redmond, Reed, and Kelly at the halfback line, Sardis, Caldwell, and Martin across the middle, Durham, Langford, and Perkins across the half forward line, Stringer, Wright, and Gresham across the full forward line, Goldstein, Setterfield, and Merritt as sort of the followers. And then the bench is Cox, Jones, Dersma, Guelphy, and Menzies, with the sub to be named just before game time from one of those five, with Draper, Laverty, and Hind as the emergencies. You never have a first team picked without some people thinking it's been a disaster, or there's certain players that shouldn't be there. But as we sort of suggested earlier, there's a much higher competition for spots, and you've also got to consider the matchups and who's playing where. And it's also important to remember that the teams don't generally line up the way that they're named anymore. What were your thoughts upon seeing the team?
Not entirely surprised. I guess the talking points here are Hobbs being left out. We did our sort of best side for round one a little while ago, and I had Hobbs out, so I'm not completely surprised. I know there's an argument now that with Parrish out, he might have been the obvious one to come in. But we've seen Durham perform really well playing inside mid over the preseason, and I think that just creates an opportunity for him and Caldwell to spend more time there. Draper being left out and running with the one ruck only came as a surprise because of what happened last season, but we did go with the one ruck during the two practice games, really. I know we sort of switched some things around at halftime, but we saw Wright play in the ruck in the first half down at Geelong as the second ruckman. I was a little bit surprised to see Hind left out. I thought he had a real impact when he came on against St Kilda and Geelong. I would have thought he would have been a candidate to play either as a small forward or be our sub. I'm not surprised that one of Kelly or Heppel was selected. A little bit surprised that they both are. I think, though, you know, with Durham, clearly I expect to get some decent midfield minutes, that does open up a spot on the wing, and Kelly's been training there in the preseason. We know he's a hard worker and he'll get back and help our defence, and that is going to be really important. And you and I sort of briefly touched on this, and I'm stealing a little bit of your thunder here, but you mentioned that Heppel could be a candidate to play on someone like Gunston, and given where Gunston's at in his footy now, he doesn't necessarily have that speed or burst that he once had. So, yeah, that is a matchup that could work for us. But I think most notably, in all the hoo-ha, the thing that's been forgotten is that we do have four guys in Goldstein, Dersma, McKay, and Gresham donning the sash for the first time. And I know they've all played plenty of senior footy, but, yeah, it's really exciting to see some new players representing Essendon Footy Club for the first time.
Yeah, I'm really keen to see how they go for the first time and cheering for them rather than against them. You mentioned Hobbs, and I think partly the reason why he's out is that, you know, he's coming off a bit of an injury and hasn't had the game time that others have had. But I also think they've decided that they're really going to back Jai Caldwell in to fill that Parrish hole in the side for the moment. He's certainly capable and threatened to break out in the past. He's had some really big games where he has been really effective in that set of square. And I think one of the other things to consider is that with both Setterfield and Durham rotating through the middle, it probably is also going to free Caldwell up to be a bit more of an attacking centre squared midfielder than he has in the past. He's often had those defensive roles or those run move roles where he sort of sacrificed his own game for the betterment of the team. Whereas with Setterfield and Durham, he can be a bit more aggressive there. And I guess for the other point from the Hobbs perspective, and this could probably also apply to say a Dylan Scheel, who maybe have been close to being fit, and they, you know, past Essendon sides may have rushed a player like him back in. But I think in the past, we've also tried to play too many midfielders. And what that's meant is that the side is a bit unbalanced. You've tried to push midfielders into forward roles where they're not quite suited, and that leaves the side a bit unbalanced. So it does seem that they're trying to get more specialists into roles, but particularly up forward, rather than trying to fill gaps with midfielders. I'm also really excited to see how Cox and Jones go in proper AFL footy. It's obviously been a while, at least in Jones' case. We did see Cox at the end of last year, and how they're going to be integrated into the side. And then I guess from a sub perspective, from the list there, I'd be having Guelphy as the sub. I think he's a bit more flexible, and I think Menzies should be just ahead of him for a starting spot at this stage.
Yeah, the other one that we didn't touch on, mate, is Elijah Sardis. So he's named on the wing. He's had a big preseason. Yeah, really excited to see what he could deliver. I think he snuck under the radar a little bit against Geelong because he played out a lot of his footy out on that far wing. So he probably didn't stand out too much in the broadcast, but certainly at ground level, it was really noticeable that his work rate was at a really high level. So I think coming in, it's a good opportunity for him to get a game under his belt with a full preseason. I mean, he didn't have the luxury of last year, but also against a team with a similar age profile through the wings and the midfield as well. So he's likely to get some matchups that are quite suitable to him. And I wonder if at times we might even see him in at the centre bounce to give us a look at something a little bit different. But that's it for us, mate. Let's have a quick look at the Hawks and how they've gone.
Yeah, and again, I'll just go through their lineup for this round one, and then after this, we'll just do changes in future episodes. So Hawthorn have, from the back line, have named Impey, Frost, and Scrimshaw. Then D'Ambrosio, Sicily, and McKenzie across the half back line. McDonald, Newcombe, and Weddle across the centre. Chole, Moore, and Watson across the half forward line. Hardwick, Lewis, and Ginnivan the full forward line. Reeves, Warden, and Nash in the ruck, and then McGuinness, Warple, Gunston, Bruce, and Amon on the bench. And the emergencies are Ramsen, Phillipson, and Hussway. Obviously, probably the most exciting thing for Hawks fans, if we want to put our put into our Hawthorn supporters' shoes, which I don't think I ever really want to do, but they're probably really excited to see how Nick Watson goes, making his debut after being drafted highly last year.
Yeah, mate, there's not a single part of me that has any interest in trying to step foot into a Hawthorn supporter's shoes. But yeah, I am looking forward to seeing Nick Watson play footy. He's a really dynamic and skilled small forward. And yeah, as you said, he comes in and plays his first game. Gunston, of course, comes in for his second coming after being at Brisbane. D'Ambrosio and Chole play their first game for Hawthorn, swapping the sleek red and black for the stripes of brown and gold. So not such a flattering look, but yeah, good luck to those guys. And yeah, it's a bit of a shame that Massimo decided to move on, but good luck to him. They have gone smaller down back than I thought they might. They're basically sort of resigned themselves to either Scrimshaw or Sicily going to have to play as a key defender. So I'm a little bit surprised Ethan Phillips didn't get selected for his first game. Dylan Moore's recovered from glandular fever. There was a bit of talk that he could miss the first month of the season. He's a really important player for them. Hopefully for our sake, he's still a little bit flat and not quite 100%. And then the other one that stood out to me, mate, is that they've selected Finn McGuinness. He was sort of didn't play big minutes in their practice games, but that probably suggests that that Zach Merritt could be up for a tag. And then I guess notably too, we've spoken about the players missing for us in Parrish and Ridley as the two notable ones. The notable ones missing for the Hawks are Will Day, who won their best and fairest last year. Jates missing, Wingard's missing, so two really skilled players that are out of their side. And I would imagine that one of Denver, Granger Barras, or James Blake would have played as a key defender had they been fit as well. So yeah, a few out for the Hawks there as well, which yeah, gives us a little bit of an advantage.
Yeah, and just touching on McGuinness potentially tagging Merritt, I think that also gives us opportunities if they do. Zach's showing that he can go forward and be dangerous and to try and break that tag. And that might also get, say, a stringer up into the middle of the ground and for a few minutes to really put a bit of excitement in there and potentially, break a game open for a couple of minutes, as a centre square midfielder to and whilst also not losing a lot by having Merritt in the forward line where he is also quite effective.
Yeah, that's exactly right, mate. And I think we'll touch on that a little bit further as we get into some of the tactics of the game.
Yeah, well, look, let's have a look at Hawthorn's performance in their last practice game. And it's a fairly similar result to what it was for Essendon and Hawthorn in round one last year, with Hawthorn 9-8-62 losing to the Western Bulldogs 17-17-119. And the Hawks actually led that game to half time, which was mainly down to the Bulldogs' inaccuracy. The Bulldogs kicked 2 goals 12 in the first half. But once the Bulldogs found their range, they pulled away quite easily with a 15-goal-3 second half, seeing them run out 57-point winners. The Bulldogs had double the inside 50s of the Hawks, 68-34, and they doubled centre clearances 17-8, which last year was a Hawthorn strength. Despite winning more of the ball, also the Bulldogs laid more tackles than the Hawks did as well, which is usually not a great sign for a side that they're losing both possession and tackles. Jai Newcombe did lead the way for the Hawks with 37 disposals, whilst Carl Amon had 28. New recruit Jack Ginnivan had 4 scoring shots for 2 goals 2, whilst Connor McDonald and Mitch Lewis both also kicked 2 goals. How did you see the game? Did you watch that?
I did, mate. I watched this. It was played out at the Witten Oval. The wind was really howling. The Bulldogs kicked 6 goals to nil in the first quarter with the advantage of that breeze. The Dogs were just a lot cleaner at the contest. And it wasn't the same old hands, although Libba did have a big game. It was some of the younger Bulldogs midfielders that were really effective as well, including their recent first round draft pick. But what it allowed them to do was just take territory and really pin the Hawks back in their back half. And when the Hawks did exit, the Dogs denied them the corridor at all costs. So, yeah, winning the ball, winning the contest, and winning clearance really did enable the Dogs to just own and play a real forward 50 game. In the second quarter, it was the opposite. It was 6 goals to 1 to Hawthorn's advantage. They used the win to get deeper entries and repeat entries. They took the corridor on a fair bit more. And then third quarter, it was again, it's sort of another 180 where the Dogs dominated the third quarter before it petered out in the last quarter, as most practice matches tend to do. I thought Ginnivan looked really busy and dangerous. I touched on that earlier. He got up the ground a fair bit more than we probably used to seeing him when he was at Collingwood. Amon was involved in a lot of their really good ball movement, and he's someone that we're going to have to be mindful of. When we think about Hawthorn's back 50, we think a lot about James Sicily and his influence, but Amon's someone who can really set them up and use his feet to get the ball in the corridor and get them going forward. And Blake Hardwick, he kicked 2 goals against us last year, as you mentioned, but he looked a handful up forward, but more out on the lead and taking marks and kicking goals rather than as a sort of traditional small forward crummer. But then the highlight for me, mate, was probably seeing Caleb Daniel matched up on Nick Watson at a couple of points there. It kind of looked like the starting gates at the Melbourne Cup rather than a game of AFL football.
Yeah, they're probably having a discussion about where they could purchase a trench coat so one could sit on the other's shoulders and they could ride some of the more dangerous rides at Movie World there. Just before we move on, I will just say that it was at York Park, the game, rather than the Wynn Oval. So, yeah, but you know, much of a muchness there. Really, the conditions in that environment are not going to what's going to be at the G. Much like we said after the St Kilda practice match, you're not going to be playing on a windy ground at the MCG. The stands really block that. So it's not as much something we have to worry about going into Saturday.
Yeah, no, well picked up, mate. Thank you.
That's all right. Well, look, let's turn our attention to the match itself. And based on last year and what we saw in the practice game against the Bulldogs, Hawthorn really struggle when they can't win contested possession. It's something that we were hot and cold at last year. So we would go +8 in wins, but -12 in losses. The corresponding match last year, we had 14 more, but this time we'll be out without Darcy Parrish, who had 18 contested possessions against the Hawks that day. How do we compensate for his loss and make sure we can get on top of contested ball?
Yeah, I think we're going to see Will Setterfield, Jai Caldwell, and Sam Durham really get their hands dirty. We're not without options there. And it can't be just one player covering the loss of our best ball winner. We are going to have to spread the load. And then Stringer and Perkins, I think, also have a role to play there too. And, you know, with the team as selected, if it does, you know, touch wood, it all goes to plan over the next 24 hours or so and those 23 run out there. I think we can afford to see Stringer through the midfield a bit more because we do have some other goal threats there. So yeah, I think it's a real case of spreading load. I think the other area we get a big advantage is in the ruck, and that helps all of our mids. Ned Reeves had a decent season last year. He's an okay ruckman, but you know he's not, and I don't think will be one of the elite ruckmen of the competition. He's a good, honest toiler. And his raw hit-out numbers compare okay to Goldstein when you look at it at a very simplistic level. But what we also saw in their clearance effectiveness and contested ball effectiveness is that first use when he was able to provide it wasn't really generating a lot of clearance for Hawthorn. The other thing that Goldstein does a lot better than Reeves is have an influence once the ball hits the ground. Goldstein's really smart in his positioning around clearances. He helps create space for his midfielders. He helps to block some passages as well defensively. And then he's also really good at getting his hands on the footy himself. He averaged 8.7 contested possessions a game last year, which I think when we went through the contested possession stats for Hawthorn last year is more than a number of their midfielders compared to Reeves at just 5.4. So yeah, I think we have the opportunity to get a real advantage in that part of the ground. I'd of course rather have Darcy playing than not, but I do think we have more than enough depth to cover it, and not just cover it, but exploit Hawthorn in that part of the game.
Yeah, and Moving on, I guess if you go back to that Hawks side that we faced last year, the biggest difference for them is going to be in their forward line. It does look like a much more dangerous forward line. The additions of Ginevan and Watson, which gives them a lot more spark in the small forward area. Chole's going to attract a big defender, and their best forward, Mitch Lewis, didn't play in round one last year. So it's a much different challenge of their forward line than it was going into last year. So how do we deal with the much more varied threats from Hawthorn this time around?
We've had criticism over the last few years, and look, justifiably so, that we're a team that likes it easy, that we like to freewheel, that we like to run and gun, that we like to bounce out of our halfback and sort of take the game on, that we're a nice team to play against. I think all of those things can be said about Hawthorn as well, particularly with the way that they've played over the last couple of years. They're a team that can really cut you up when you allow the game to be played on their own terms. But when you bring pressure and a real fierceness at the contest, then they can also fall apart. And part of that is because they do have a really young midfield and they just don't have that depth or experience through there yet to be able to compete. But I also think it's because of the game style that Sam Mitchell is implementing and the emphasis on run and carry and offensive play. We need to help our defenders out through the middle of the ground and take a leaf out of what the Bulldogs did successfully in that practice match down in Launceston. Thanks again, Humey. Western Oval and Launceston, both places I never want to go to watch football again. So easy mistake to make. But yeah, the way that they were able to limit Hawthorn's access to the corridor is a real blueprint to how I think you can limit the damage. It's a lot easier for our defenders to defend one side of the ground than it is to obviously open the ground up and have to defend an entire back 50. So I think the key here is being balanced and physical at the contest. And by balance, that means not everyone gets sucked into the ground ball, but when it is your turn to go, that you go. And we saw some good examples of that against Geelong when our more experienced heads were around the footy. You know, Parrish, Merritt, Gresham and the like, Stringer, were really effective at almost taking it in turns to go into the contest. And then when our younger mids took over later in that game, we lost that balance. So it's important that we keep that up. That also means that we get deep entries inside 50. We don't have to worry and shouldn't worry too much about being clean and trying to mark everything. If we can get the ball in there ugly, we can keep it in and we can lock it in. Then we give ourselves time to set up the ground and get that high press. And I'd also be really mindful of the impact that Amon and Impey can have, as well as Weddle. So, yeah, they do have some good users. D'Ambrosio is another one. But Impey and Amon are probably the two that I'd really be keeping a close eye on and not letting them happen. Get too much uncontested ball. So yeah, if we can do all of those things, shut off the corridor, then I think we can. Then the rest and their dangerous forwards kind of look after themselves, because our defenders aren't going to have to worry about as much fast ball movement, too many one-on-one contests they can set up, and you know, the likes of Reid and Mackay can do what they can do. They do best and intercept the ball in the air.
Yeah. Well, look, as uncomfortable a thought as it is, imagine you're Sam Mitchell for a second. What do you think he's going to be most concerned about facing Essendon? And what would you be doing to ensure that we're able to use the advantages that we have to its fullest?
Sorry, mate. I just tried to imagine that I was Sam Mitchell and it took me to some really dark places that I don't want to go to again. Look, I think he will be trying to limit the influence of Merritt and Martin. I think he will tag Merritt. That's the only reason McGuinness is in the side. I can't imagine that he's in there to do anything other than tag. I expect Merritt. It could be Martin, but I think it will likely be Merritt. I wouldn't be afraid to send Merritt to half forward. You touched on that, if McGuinness does do that, because I do think then that gives us the flexibility to use Stringer or Perkins or someone else in the midfield and you know, replace the influence that Zach can have around the ball. But what it will also do is force one of Hawthorne's really good ball users away from halfback and have to be used elsewhere. And Zach can just go and clog up an area that you know, can limit Hawthorne's effectiveness when they're trying to exit the back 50. The other thing that we know about Zach is that he pressures really well and that he's really, he's almost a psycho. He's a dog with a bone when it comes to tackling and pressuring. So I think moving him to half forward can really work to our advantage if we can get the right impetus from the likes of Stringer and Perkins when they go into the midfield to replace him. So yeah, I think you'll be concerned about those guys. And I think we need to be bold with, you know, the ball in hand and really hit that corridor, because we do have plenty of goal threats with Wright, with Langford, with Stringer, with Perkins, along with, you know, Jones, Gresham and Menzies, who can all play roles. And with Hawthorn's lack of key defenders, it forces Sicily to be really accountable. In an ideal world, Sicily would be their third tall. He's probably going to have to play a role on one of Wright or Langford, or Jones for that matter. And Jones is someone who we know can be really good at dragging a quality defender away. Yeah, I think he's going to have plenty to think about with our dangerous ball movers, and then our dangerous forwards, and the options that we've got there with their lack of defenders.
Yeah, and just on trying to get that corridor, that's where Nick Martin becomes really important with the role that he's been playing over the off-season or the pre-season games there. And, you know, we've seen him hit up some of those difficult kicks that open up opportunities for us in moving forward. And again, you know, making sure we're getting the ball in his hand so he can get it into dangerous positions, but also not being too reliant on him so we can be easily shut down with our ball movement.
Yeah, and Perkins too, in that matters, that high half forward, shared some data on Twitter or X yesterday. Archie Perkins, so of any Essendon player last year who had 20 or more kicks inside 50, Archie Perkins created the most goals from his kicks that went inside 50, and a lot of that is because of where he kicks from. He gets the ball in the corridor, and that allows us to get better looks at goal. And that's despite him not having, I think he had the third most kicks inside 50. So yeah, third most kicks, but the most goals coming from those kicks. So yeah, I think Perkins has a big role to play in that as well.
Absolutely. Well, look, let's turn to our final thought. And given we also faced Hawthorn in round one last year, I thought it was fitting that we would have the same final thought that we did for that game this year. So look, Jono, finish this thought. I'm looking forward to.
Looking forward to being back at the G, mate. Sunny day, big crowd, big game, old rival. What's not to love, mate? What about you?
Yeah, that's a fair call there. I'm really looking forward to seeing how our new recruits connect with the players that were already there. And I think if we see that they have developed good connections with the other players quickly, it's going to be a good sign that we'll be able to start the season well. And someone we haven't really touched on, but I'm really excited to see Zach Reid get a run at it, not having to be the number one key defender, getting to learn and build relationship with Ben Mackay, I think is really exciting.
Yeah, it's an interesting point on Zach Reid too, mate. Without the recruitment of Ben Mackay, we'd be looking at, you know, without Ridley there, we'd be looking at Zach Reid playing on Mitch Lewis, their number one key forward. So yeah, I have to admit I sort of glanced over him, but I'm looking forward to seeing him out on the G as well.
Yeah. Well, look, that'll wrap us up for tonight. Big thanks to you, Jono, for all your hard work this week. We'll also be recording our first regular season First Thoughts episode on Saturday night. As we said earlier on this year, those First Thought episodes are going to be exclusive to the Patreon. So if you do want to hear our initial reactions to the game, the link to the Patreon can be found in the description of this episode. Jono, any final words from you?
No, mate, thank you. Yeah, really looking forward to getting to the G on Saturday.
Yeah, me too. Stay safe, everyone, and go Dons.